Good morning. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock, and I'm Gene Purcell filling in for Joy Cardine this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The fall elections for 2006 are still fresh in our memories. The race for president in 2008 is already heating up, and you might think from all that that what happened last fall and what is in the process of occurring right now, that American democracy is alive and well. Well, not so, says our guest, who argues that the present state of American democracy is a long way away from what the founders of the government envisioned. Kevin O'Leary is a former newspaper journalist and currently a senior research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of California in Irvine. In his book, Saving Democracy, published last year, he argues that there is a growing disconnect between the American people and their elected representatives. He says part of it is a simple math equation. As the population grows, more and more members of the public are represented by the same number of federal legislators. Right now, he says, a congressional representative represents about 650,000 people, and that number is only going to go up. Well, he's got a plan to change that and to set up what he calls the People's House and get more people involved in the process. What do you think about the state of American democracy? Is Kevin O'Leary correct? Are there too many people right now to be effectively represented by 435 members of Congress? And can his plan, the formation of a People's House, really help alleviate that? Or is democracy just fine the way it is? And are the real problems of government to be found elsewhere? We'd like you to call with your questions and comments. Our number is 800-642-1234, or if you are calling from the Madison area, it is 263-1890. And don't forget, you can also join us via email, and that address is talk@wpr.org. Kevin O'Leary, good morning, and welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning.
Good to have you along. Let's begin at the beginning. When did you start getting concerned about the state of American democracy?
Well, you know, growing up like everybody else, watching what's been happening, and there's been a shift. One thing I don't talk about too much in the book because it's kind of known, the shift from kind of party-based politics to more consultant-based politics.
Yes.
And we've seen that since, I think of it kind of like politics post-John Kennedy. And until Kennedy ran, the party bosses basically ran things. And you had a convention that was kind of locally based parties like Mayor Daley of old. And the party brokers would get together and decide who the nominee was going to be. And at that time, if they didn't think you were ready, they might say, you know, Joe, come back in 4 years. And after the 68 convention, that fell apart with the McGovern reforms and the protests, and we moved to a primary-based system. And now we've got a situation where we're looking ahead to next year where they may move up big primaries like California to February. And all of a sudden, bang, we may have the nominee picked by, 8 months before the 8 months or more before the general election.
And if I'm remembering correctly, and I'm not sure that I am, but I remember that book, The Selling of the Presidency. Wasn't that about the 68 election?
The first one was about the 60 election.
That's right, that's right.
And then Teddy White was a great journalist, and he kept doing them.
Yes.
So very much. Well, anyway, the consultant politics, it's changed politics drastically. It's much more TV-driven, much more personality and charisma driven than before, and so that's changed things quite a bit, and at least the parties were corrupt in a sense, you know, that we had problems with different local machines and kind of patronage and gross types of corruption in the past, and they were sometimes closed machines, but at the other side of it was that people had a chance to work their way into the machine and get involved. And one thing that people noticed was that there was a connection between, or there were two things. The local machines, they wanted to elect people, obviously, from dog catcher up to U.S. Senator. But they were also very concerned about what happened when we governed. And so you could think of Harry Truman. And be a good example, coming from Kansas City, he didn't get into politics till late in life. He had to work on the farm. He goes to war, and he comes back, and he happened to be in the World War One with the local machine boss's son, who was very impressed with him and encouraged him to get involved. All of a sudden, he ends up running for office after he's like 40, and he's the county commissioner in Kansas City, like a county supervisor type position. And he does a great job building roads. And all of a sudden, he's picked to run for U.S. Senate. And he becomes senator from Missouri. Well, the Pendergast machine, they cared very much about winning the campaigns. They also cared about what you do in office. Same thing with Senator Wagner from New York. So there was a connection between the two.
And I want to talk about that connection because that is sort of the whole premise of your book is sort of hinging on that. And part of it has to do with the numbers. You talk at length about the population of America going up substantially. And there's a line from your book I'd like to read because I think it kind of gets to the heart of things. It is not hard to hold elections, but it is hard to make democracy meaningful. And I think that is sort of the essential challenge that you see right now in terms of our current system.
Yes, and when you look at the numbers, and you have that situation of going from 3 million population at the beginning of the country to 300 million, we just hit that this fall.
Yeah.
And you start with 1 to 30,000 congressional districts from Madison's time, and now 1 to 650,000. So how do you make democracy meaningful? And I think that's a real challenge.
Especially when you cite the Madison quite a bit in the book, and one of his concerns, as I recall, was that ratio, that he felt that the government should be relatively close to the people, and part of it was in having a reasonable number of people being represented by somebody in Congress.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Madison has a reputation because he's a very bold thinker. He's not a political theorist who's, you know, of the, what in political science would say, of the terrific first rank, like Aristotle or Machiavelli or Hegel or something like that. But he's really, really good. And he's also a practical politician. He looks at what's happening. He says, we're going to have a large country, he thinks. And so he says, we don't have to. He challenges what is the orthodoxy of democracy has to take place in a small city-state. And he basically challenges Montesquieu and everybody back to Aristotle and says, no, we could do it on a national scale. And this is what he does in Federalist Number 10. And in doing that, he's taking a risk, saying we can make it better. And he basically deals with this famous point that a lot of people know about, of factions, kind of city-state, Romeo and Juliet. He says, if you got that promise of narrow, focused interest groups, focused on their own little thing, if you enlarge the scale and extend the scope of democracy, you can involve more people. And he thinks by having these large districts, you can somewhat insulate the representatives from the petty politics and also overwhelm the interest groups. That's kind of his hope. He wants to get something like that Sam Beer at Harvard calls civic majorities. His mm-hmm. goal is to kind of have third parties look at things who aren't so driven by the passions of the particular interest group make the decisions for the country. Now, in doing that, he's an elitist of the time. The founders aren't that sure, especially the Federalists, of the people and how democracy is going to work. So they're pitted against the anti-Federalists, who are more locally based and more small scale. And this goes to the scale point. But, and so in coming up with the Constitution, the president is insulated in the sense it's going to be picked by the Electoral College, which comes out of state legislatures, and the election of senators, we have to remember, that doesn't change until the progressives. And that's an indirect election coming out of the state legislatures. And then the House of Representatives, that's the one portion of the federal government that he wants to have a, quote, intimate connection to the population, to the public. And they make the districts 1 to 30,000. The anti-Federalists don't like that. They think that's way too large. We would think that would be wonderful if we could do that now.
So it's funny how things change. We're going to be taking a break here, and we'll continue with sort of defining the problem, but you've got some solutions, and we're going to be getting to those pretty quickly as well. In the meantime, if you'd like to join in the conversation, join us at 800-642-1234. That's our toll-free number. You can also call us in Madison. It is 263-1890. What do you think about the state of democracy in America right now and Kevin O'Leary's assertion that we've got too many people being represented by too few people, I guess would be the simple way to put it. We'll find out what his plans are to turn that all around. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm filling in for Joy Cardine today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 21 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 9 with Kathleen Dunn, archaeologists this week discovered the 4,600-year-old ruins of a Neolithic village near Stonehenge in southern England. It suggests the ancient structure was just one half of a larger complex. After 9, Kathleen Dunn and her guests talk about Stonehenge, who lived there, and why. That's up after 9. Here on the Ideas Network. During this hour, we are talking with Kevin O'Leary. He is the author, among other things, of Saving Democracy, A Plan for Real Representation in America. And part of the premise of his book is that as the American population has continued to grow, the idea of democracy, the way the founders set it up, has changed substantially from what they intended. And those numbers don't exactly work anymore. And Kevin O'Leary, in your book, you talk about kind of the current state of things. You take a look at some of the voting rates, how they've been mostly falling over the years. You talk about what you call deep apathy and a passive public. And you also argue with the notion that the voting, the system of voting, the system of polls that we have, and special interest groups really represent our needs. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that for a little bit. And because right now, if you talk to politicians, they'll say, well, people vote for me. We've got polls that tell us what the people think. And, of course, there are special interest groups that represent interests of all sorts of different political parties. Why isn't that system good enough in your estimation?
Okay, first off, yes, the voting rates have gone down from where they were. We had a surge with the last election, but we're still not where we were in 1960 when we had about 60% of the public vote. We've fallen down where kind of 50% of voters voting is kind of the norm. And then you have municipal, you know, if you have off-year elections or municipal elections, even after the riots in L.A. in 92, the mayor's race, it was still under 25% voting for mayor, which was quite discouraging. So we have what I would think, and a lot of people I think would agree, a spectator culture. And having the presidential race open up so suddenly and being off so quickly, when it used to be called the hidden primary, it was the year before Iowa, was kind of quiet except for the insiders and the race to raise money. Now it's all out there, so it's interesting. But we kind of live in a situation where we even people like listening to this show and who follow politics, who read the major newspapers, try to educate themselves, what can they actually do? They can write a check, obviously. They can join an interest group. They can vote. They can write letters. But after those things, what can you do? And we can get polled, yes. We feel a sense of, you know, quote, maybe symbolic participation with the polls. But there's a problem with this. The research shows, and there's a very good book by John Zaylor at UCLA about what the polls do, and he argues, I think, persuasively, that what happens is you only need 1,000 people for a national poll in a country of 300 million, sorry. And when they make the phone call and you pick it up, if you ever get that call, I myself have not got one. My wife finally got one this year during the races. Off-season, off-year elections, you are often so busy with dinner or whatever, and you haven't thought about things, and maybe you saw a cover of Newsweek or The New York or something about a major issue, but you hadn't picked it up, and it's like, here's your chance. So a lot of the reactions are off the top of the head, kind of just kind of impressions about the issue being asked about. And, yes, you can get gross measurements of where the public's attitudes are in terms of things, the Iraq war, for example, that's an issue that's so large, and you'll have movement. But it's not thoughtful, considered, studied reactions. So there's a question of how could you do it better? How could you have a situation where people were involved and you had a better situation than the current public opinion polls? And also, the interest groups. Yes, we can be involved with an interest group. The way the system's set up now is the people who are elected, we hope, we'd like to think that the people in Congress will consider all the points of view and kind of sit back, as Madison hoped, and think about what's good for the general population, kind of the civic majority idea. But money is such a factor of the system, and it's not going to change given the Supreme Court ruling in the Buckley decision that money is equal to free speech, and therefore it's important. And if you're rich, you get to say what you want. That kind of hurts the situation of kind of equal citizenship and being equal as a political person. But it's there. And so the interest groups, they can lobby Congress, they can lobby the committees, they can lobby the individual senators and House members and give significant campaign contributions so that all of a sudden when you're a member of Congress, you really have to think about that in your coming election and taking that money. And the interest groups have a way of getting to you. It's not corrupt in the way that, say, Randy sent the House member, Congressman Randy Cunningham out in San Diego, was blatant. That's the old-fashioned type of corruption. But it's corrupting nonetheless, and I think a number of influential people, such as former Senator Bill Bradley and others, see it as a insidious shaping of the system, the money influence.
Yeah, insidious was kind of the word I was, and it sort of can sneak up on you.
Yeah, and so that's there. That has shaped the system. So I was trying to think, what is a way to take American politics as it is, not running off someplace else, off to ideas coming out of Europe? What's in our traditions that we could, elements that we could take and work on and kind of reshape or reform that we could add a little something to the system to help us at this time?
And I want to jump ahead a bit here because you've got a couple of proposals. Virtual national assemblies, the People's House, are the two that I remember. And do you see, first I want you to talk about those a little bit, but then keeping in mind, do you see this as an evolution of building upon what we already have?
It'd be building upon what we already have. My basic starting point is this. If you look at democracy as a conception, you have like a... At one pole, you have Rousseau and direct democracy.
Mm-hmm.
People like the idea of small situations. The other side is Madison and large representative government. And we don't think of having the ability to do anything in the middle. The progressives were bold. They said, living in 1900, we think we need to do something here. They came up with a city manager form of government, the primary system, the direct election of senators. And they came up with kind of basically the idea of kind of direct mass democracy, where they borrowed from both ends, where they said, we've got representative government, we want to supplement that with not small-scale direct democracy, but large-scale. And so California and a lot of the western states, I was just on a panel last Friday in Colorado and Denver to talk about this, and Washington, Oregon, have the initiative system. And it's been a big player in politics in those specific states for the last 30 years.
All the various propositions and so forth.
Yeah, but they can take, there's a good part of it. Those states kind of track public's feelings about situations. They can get to problems sooner, but the result that you get through the initiative system isn't always good. And people in Colorado are upset about one right now where both the proponents and the opponents say the thing they passed in November, I wish we'd worked on it more and the language is better, et cetera, et cetera. So my idea is, at this time, start of the 21st century, we can also look at the system, and a number of people within political science have been thinking about discussing what deliberative democracy would be, kind of more discussion, and how could you institute that is my question. So I've got two proposals, basically saying, look, this is where we are now. What if you took the town hall tradition which we all understand.
Sure, a bunch of people in a room, citizens talking about ideas.
Right. And we take the reality, the great reality of the Internet of the last 15, 20 years, and we combine those two things. Everybody understands what those are. And we said, keep the system as it is. So we've got two houses of Congress, the president, Supreme Court, and the court system. And we make a small addition on the legislative side, kind of an advisory situation, and we call this a citizens' assembly. We would start it at the state level, but on a national scale, you would have 100 people per congressional district. And they would meet in a town hall fashion a couple times a month. Serving on this panel would be a time demand. So if you were picked to do this and you said you would, it would be similar to being on a city council or a school board. But you could keep your, you would keep your job, you keep your career, you meet twice a month, and you'd be, have a 2-year term. You'd be a delegate to the assembly.
And you would, now this would be a delegate to the assembly, and you would advise who? Your representative in Congress on issues of the day?
Well, not exactly. That would be a little more indirect. You would look at the biggest issues facing the country, and you would debate and talk about them and study them, and you would come to a decision and take a vote in your own local assembly and all the other ones across the country in 435 districts. And the basic thing comes back to scale again. We could, what can we do about the size, back to our initial point? You'd have to quadruple the size of the House to have any impact on us as voters. But that would destroy the House's effectiveness. If we think it works badly now, it would work a lot worse if we did that. So if we, what's an alternative? We could have 100 people in each district. So you come to about roughly 43,000 people involved out of 300 million. So it would be a small subset of folks. We would ask them to be super citizens, in a sense, for 2 years to focus on issues and pay attention, debate with themselves, and the result would be another measure of public opinion, that they would do what's kind of deliberative public polls. And this would be a poll where you'd ask people after they'd studied an issue, what do you think? And that might be quite different. I mean, you might have the ABC, New York Times poll, et cetera, and you might have a poll of the assembly, and they might come to a different thought about what we should do about, say, HMO reform.
1-800-642-1234 is the toll-free number if you'd like to join in the conversation. We have an open line for you. In Madison, it is 263-1890. Let's go to the phone right now and take some questions, some comments for our guest. We go to Milwaukee, and Peter joins us. Hi, Peter.
Yes, good morning. For Mr. O'Leary, I've got two improvements I think would work, would help the, on the, certainly the federal level, but perhaps on all political levels. Look, I'm now pushing 70 years. I think I'm really fed up with some of the foolishness that comes out of Washington and other sites. So try this. Number one, in election categories, how about add none of the above as a serious entry, and instead of having to take the worst or the least worst of whatever whoever's been offered to the citizens, but none of the above should be embedded in the election system. Number two, how about revising the terms of the House of Representatives? Now, this is a federal level, from 2 years to four, so that it takes a while just to learn the job. Local levels are all usually 4 years anyway. But go to the 4 years and somehow have to have a constitutional amendment for that, of course. But then also, it gives a chance for the representatives to spend much more time on doing their jobs instead of having spent endless hours and time fundraising all the time. I don't think we're getting our dollars worth of value from the current system. What do you think about that?
All right, Peter, thanks for the call. And Kevin O'Leary, you don't address those specifically in your book, but what do you think about none of the above? I heard a chuckle there on the other end of the line.
Yeah.
And then revising terms of the House of Representatives, that might be a partial solution to some of this, I guess, but it doesn't really get at that numbers issue that you're concerned with.
Right. On the first one, it is a chuckle, but not in a bad way. I mean, I think it'd be kind of interesting. I don't know if it's as serious as the second one. But, you know, now you just wonder sometimes when you're in, you've got a forced choice of two candidates that are the major parties to choose from, and sometimes people just aren't happy with what you've been presented. So it really would be a gauge of what people thought about the choice they have to make. That'd be interesting. The second one I've thought about, and it goes to the Constitution, and they wanted to have the House having two members, two-year terms, versus the six in the Senate. Yes, it would give them more time to learn things. They wouldn't have to work on fundraising so much. But you have this problem of you don't have the feedback loop that you have now. And it turns out that that's a very important feedback loop with the off-year election having a four-year term for president. It's kind of integral to the system. If we did this with a four-year term, then it probably would be matched. It is matched with the presidential election. And we don't have a way to give feedback to, say, President Bush in the current situation right now.
Let's go to another call right now. Jerry joins us in Neillsville. Hi, Jerry.
Well, I think I might have been talking to your screener. Somebody asked the same or made the same comment that I did as I'm now listening to you. Really, what I was saying is, for me, when I vote, I vote, obviously, in the presidential because I think I can impact that. But some of the other, not only in the Senate, or excuse me, in the state level, but also at the federal level, I just don't think that my vote's going to matter. I mean, there were a couple of people like last year, Obi ran, and he didn't even go out and campaign. It was such a shoo-in. Cole was exactly the same way. And so I guess I agree with everything that your speaker's saying, but I'd like to add into that what you've already talked about, and that is that I just really believe that there should be some term limits. You know, recently somewhere they're thinking about eliminating their term limits because, well, the comment was, wait, you just can't get it done in 12 years. Well, you know, if you can't get it done in 12 years, after 12 months, I'd be fired if I didn't get it done. And I just think that we should have something like that in concert with what you're saying about. Now, another issue is these guys, to change term limits, well, that's like the fox, guarding the hen house. And I think there should be some other body that controls such thing as whether they should get a pay raise or not. So I agree with everything you're saying. Thanks.
All right, Jerry, thanks for your call. And he was referring to Representative Obi there as a shoo-in and Senator Cole. And why bother voting for them if you know they're going to win? He also brings up the idea of term limits. And I'm interested in your take on that, Kevin O'Leary.
Yes, term limits. I live in California. We've got the most severe term limits in the country, at least tied for them. And it's a real problem here of leadership. That's the key thing that people see in the state assembly. We have just six-year terms. So you get elected, you just kind of learn your way to, say, the bathroom, so forth, so to speak, in the first two. Then you're in this kind of competition for leadership, and you finally get to be elected leader, and you have 2 years left, and it just goes zip. And any institutional memory or kind of training or preparation on your part to be an effective leader of the state assembly kind of goes out the window. I mean, Mayor Villaraigosa, who's highly thought of as the mayor of Los Angeles, he's doing a fine job. He got to be speaker at the assembly, and then he was right out. So that's an issue people don't necessarily think about. I mean, if you have longer terms, 12 years or something, maybe that's a situation. Now, the Supreme Court's ruled at that at the federal level and said, nope, that's not in the Constitution. We don't want to do that. It's up to the people to make the decision. The real problem, of course, right now is that the redistricting with computers makes it such that the two parties can have kind of an incumbency protection law. And there's so few House races that are really competitive that most districts are drawn, so it's, you know, the incumbent has a large advantage in terms of party registration. It's hard to have the incumbent worry about the population, which is not how it should be. I mean, I'd love to see a change on that. At the same time, if that's not going to change, what I'm talking about is an addition, is something, a reform that could get the politicians' attention and would help us have a voice beyond the presidential race. So let me go back to that and say the basic proposal is an assembly of 100 people per congressional district, and they would then be connected via the internet with similar bodies across the country in all these congressional districts. And they would have the task of being, quote, what I call super citizens, of paying attention to the most important issues, debating those, thinking about them, and representing us in terms of what average folks think about what's happening in the country and how we can improve things and make progress on the biggest issues.
We're going to take a break right now and return back to our conversation with Kevin O'Leary, the author of Saving Democracy, and we are talking about his plan for real representation in America. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number that you can call if you'd like to join in the conversation. In Madison, it is 263-1890. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 19 minutes before 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Joy Cardine today. Coming up after 5, At Issue with Ben Marins. When a marriage ends, it's not just couples and their children who are hurt. Ben talks with a guest who offers advice for the parents of adult children who divorce. That's up after 5 this afternoon here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we are talking with Kevin O'Leary. He is the author of the book Saving Democracy, A Plan for Real Representation in America. And we had just gotten to the part where we are talking about some of his solutions to what he sees as a lack of representation for average people in America. Now, one of the questions that you haven't answered yet, Kevin O'Leary, is how people get to represent these districts. And it winds up, if I remember correctly, that you favor choosing people by lot as opposed to electing them.
Yes, and I struggle with this because you could easily have the 100 people per district selected by election, and they could have a piggyback election to the congressional representative. But you do have strong partisanship. We go through periods in the country, and we're in one right now. And it will be probably the situation that the local parties, machines, or candidate organizations would try to take this process over. And you might end up electing people that are the key supporters of the congressman to this forum. And so I thought, well, what's a different way to do it? Some political scientists talk about random selection. There's a part of the book has a little bit back to Athens because they have some interesting things. One of them is lot, that they picked people by lot. And so it's a random situation, and I decide that's how we would choose people. That way you don't have to campaign. You don't have to raise the money to campaign. A lot of people who would be very good in public life and make a strong contribution wouldn't want to go through a campaign. So we kind of skip that arduous step and say, you get a letter, basically, like jury service in a sense. Would you like to be a delegate to the assembly?
So
and
you'd
if
give,
you say yes, yeah.
Yeah, you'd give people the option to say no.
Yes, and I mean, I think you'd be bad if you compelled people to do this. I mean, maybe you have to give some kind of economic inducement, some kind of cash incentive.
A per diem or a stipend or something?
A per diem, and maybe you look at a sliding scale depending on what a person's income is and so forth. But basically you're saying you're going to be like, it's going to be like similar, like I said before, like to a city council or a school board. It's going to take some time. So you have to make dedicated to that. But by lot, you would have a cross-section of people. You'd have, lower income, middle income, higher income. You'd have all kinds of ethnic and racial diversity. So you'd get a rough cross-section of every district, and you have minority views that aren't heard now because we have single-member districts. That's a technical term for it. Basically, 50% wins. Who has the most votes in that district? You'd have kind of this underneath. We give a tapestry of what the district's really about.
Let's find out what listeners think and go to a call from Eric, who joins us from Madison this morning. Hi, Eric.
Yes, hi. Yeah, I had a comment and maybe a question. An example, in Sweden, that's a country of 9 million people. I just calculated here. They have one representative in their national parliament for every 25,788 person. And the polls in the U.S., I have been surprised. I mean, there they often ask around 2,000 people every time they do public polls. And, yeah, my question would be, what about party politics in your models?
All right, Eric, thanks for the call. And Kevin O'Leary, party politics, as I understand your proposal, would still exist. In other words, a member of Congress would still be a member of a party. It is when you get down to the Citizens Assembly that partisanship doesn't really become a factor because they are chosen by lot.
Right. Now, yes, the lot would make it more nonpartisan in a sense, but people would not, and you wouldn't campaign on a platform because you're picked by lot.
Yep.
But people would come in with their own personal views and their partisan politics. So partisanship isn't left at the door. You're not asked to come into the forum, the Citizens Assembly, and basically leave everything, your identity, behind. No, you are who you are, and you grew up in this community, right? So in that sense, you're very linked to where you are geographically. And so it's another form of geographic representation, the same as we've got when we elect a representative to Congress.
So actually, partisan, I was just sort of thinking while you were talking there, if you had a district, say, that was heavily Republican and you had an election by lot, you could probably would wind up with a largely Republican Citizens Assembly in that case, which in that case would be a very close representation of the district.
Uh-huh. And they might mirror the representative's views, right, the person mm-hmm. in Congress from that district. But maybe they're not as ideological as the person in Congress, or strongly partisan in, you know, an ideological sense, that they're Republicans, but they're, you know, more open on certain issues. I think one thing I think would happen with this would we'd find the kind of the moderate middle would have a chance to join the discussion. And that's talked about quite a bit these days with the partisanship, the strong partisanship in Washington. And I think this would be a vehicle, a forum where that could emerge. Because right now with party politics, you're kind of forced into a mold at either extreme sometimes with the way the Bush White House has approached politics. And not everybody in the country fits that way. A lot of people are more in the middle and don't feel the same way on every issue that they are strong Republicans or strong Democrats.
Now, your book came out last year before the elections, as I recall. And so it's been out for a while. And I know you were hoping it would have some sort of impact on last fall's elections. What has the reception to your book been? I mean, are people reading it, first of all? And secondly, are they reacting to it as a valid suggestion?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think it was going to, you know, affect the election or anything like that. It is a time where people are interested in, like, what can we do? There's been a lot of books over the last 20 years complaining about politics,
yep,
giving a critique of the system. And I just decided if I'm going to write something like this, I want to make a contribution to a solution to get people thinking, what could we actually do? And so I've gotten good response. I mean, both academics and journalists and regular people, when I talk to them, when I've heard from them, they're interested. They get the idea. It's not a hard concept, having a town hall situation and actually giving it some power. And a lot of people, I mean, I've had this question about the partisanship, what we were just recently on, whether that's a mistake to take the partisanship out. And I'm saying you can bring your partisan views into this. And most people think it's fine the way I've set it up. Most people react, say, yeah, it's way too partisan right now, in the sense it would be nice to have an element to the system that wasn't totally partisan.
So who would be opposed to it? I mean, the usual suspects here would be the status quo.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're a beneficiary of the system, it's not easy to get into politics now and be successful. It's a real career. So any uncertainty, and that's why the districts are redistricted to protect the incumbents. So this would be something new. And so a lot of politicians would be uncomfortable. A lot of interest groups who benefit from the system would be maybe uncomfortable. But I'm not talking to them necessarily. I'm talking to the rest of us who were, as we said at the beginning, forced into a role of spectator and trying to have a way we could have intelligent, meaningful participation in the country. And it can't be for everybody because we've got such a large country. But we need to have a group of people who have a voice who can supplement what's going on when you have a system right now of kind of an elite group that's very focused on politics, but a very small group, maybe a million or a half a million people that are the consultant class, the elite journalists, the politicians, the big funders, and then the rest of us, 299 million plus. How can we participate? How can we have a voice in the situation? And what we should get to is the second part of the reform before we finish up.
Yeah, let me take a call, and then we'll come back and tie it up with the second part of that reform. Josh would like to participate in the conversation and have a voice. Hi, Josh.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going fine.
Great. I just want to thank you guys for the program. Kevin, I like your ideas. They're real forward-thinking. about the size of the country getting bigger, democracy must shift with it. And my idea was, been thinking this for a while, is that if we want to be serious about democracy, we're going to have to make the election day a national holiday, and it's going to have to be more than 11 hours of voting time. It's going to be 2-3 days. It seems funny to me that we take more time to decide the World Series champion. You need at least 4 games there, and golf tournaments are held for at least 3 or 4 days. And it's hard for people to take off work. It's hard for people to drop the kids off. And, you know, if we can make 4th of July a holiday to light off fireworks, it seems if we're going to be serious about democracy, we need to make that a national holiday and get people out there and celebrate it. That was my thoughts.
All right, Josh, thanks for the thoughts. Kevin O'Leary, what do you think? Should it be a holiday?
I think it could well be a holiday. And Josh makes very valid points to try to make it easier for people to actually do their civic obligation. There are countries that actually require you to vote, but we don't like compulsion in America. We're too into individual liberty, and so I don't compel people to say I'd be a delegate to the People's House. I mean, I think you'd have, if people came out of high school, say, and they knew the system existed, I think they would say, gosh, if I got that letter, I think I might do it. And if this proposal got some steam and was tried in some states and actually happened, after 10 years, everybody would know, you know, Uncle Fred or a friend of a friend had done this. And all of a sudden, we'd feel a connection to the government, which is our government, that we don't have right now. In terms of that this is not just out of left field and kind of just my idea, it's an idea that's been percolating in political science, and it's kind of like, how do you take these ideas and give them institutional grounding to make democracy better? It's actually happening. British Columbia has gone forward with an electoral reform where they gave a citizens' assembly, like I'm talking about, the power to try to reshape and talk about how we should reshape politics and elections in British Columbia. And then they took it to the voters to have a vote on what they came up with. In California, we had a proposal about a citizens' assembly, about a single issue at a time, kind of a grand jury system. Senator Wyden and Senator Hatch have actually passed legislation in the Congress about health care. The next time they say we do health care in the country seriously, we should have town hall meetings at the grassroots level to find out what people want. And that's actually legislation. It doesn't have much teeth in it, but it actually exists. So it's kind of like this is, I think, a coming wave. This is kind of like a reform that's gradually starting to open up, and people are starting to talk about how could you have a citizens' assembly. My proposal goes beyond advocacy, though, or advice, right? Because
indeed,
too often you can have a commission and it's a white paper, it goes on the shelf. So I've been trying to think, how can you have a town hall situation, a national citizens' assembly or a state citizens' assembly, and have them have some impact on the state legislature, actually? Well, they would have this ability to have polls about what they think. But if it worked, you could go the next step, which would be to give them power, and you could give them limited legislative power, not committee work, but it would be the same structure. I just call the second stage of the reform the People's House. And here they would have the ability to basically veto bills or send bills back to the House or the Senate if they thought there was big problems. And a couple examples. Whether or not you agreed with the original Patriot Act, the way it was passed was abominable and kind of just a shame, because it was passed almost in the middle of the night with nobody in Congress having a chance to read the bill. So even if you're a strong proponent that it was written exactly the way you want it as a citizen, you might say, wait a second, you shouldn't pass the bill like that. The people in Congress who are elected, the 435 and 100 senators, they should actually read this, something important as this. So you could kick bills back that you didn't like that came out of the House or the Senate. Secondly, you could have an affirmative power of, a lot of times now, a bill that's very popular, say coming up HMO reform, that might have 60 to 70% public support in the polls, but it's held up in committee for whatever reason, committee chairman or the House leadership, Senate leadership. That's not in the Constitution. That's just something that Congress decided early in the 20th century. So you could have a power of the People's House to say, we are going to have a vote among ourselves about this bill, And we think it should be a floor vote. We want to push it out of committee to the floor and see what our elected representatives think about this matter. So you could give the People's House limited but potent legislative authority. They could also propose bills and referendums. I mean, they could have some limited powers in addition to that.
Let's find out what Dave in Brussels thinks about all of this. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. Thank you. There's a little time left. I think the biggest problem your previous caller touched on, and that's the lack of involvement on the local level. I mean, there's just not enough people voting. And, you know, short-term stopgap solutions to try to, correct that, I guess, almost by tricks, doesn't seem to me to be a very good long-term solution. And part of the problem is that there's too many people that look to the federal level for everything. Local government is much more dealing with people where they live. But the biggest problem is people need to be better educated and they need to be more involved, not just in federal elections, but in local elections. Because it's the people's government, and it's, you know, to just look to Washington and what's done in Washington is part of the problem. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you for your call. Kevin O'Leary, he touches upon some of the same problems that we've been talking about for the past hour. And I guess I have to ask you whether you kind of feel like you're tilting at windmills here. Because this, in some ways, it is a sort of a building on what the foundation already is. In other ways, it is a terrible threat to the status quo. And the status quo right now, for better or for worse, is who's holding the cards.
That's true, but... I start the book by saying, even on the first page, in business we expect innovation all the time, every quarter with companies almost, right?
Mm-hmm.
In politics we kind of think, well, the founders set the system up and there hasn't been that much innovation. But that's not true. We invented political parties with Jackson in the 1830s. The progressives came up with these bold reforms at the turn of the century. Roosevelt and the New Deal transformed American government and politics. The 60s. Etc. So we hit periods where we're ready for change and we want to do something and we want to make the system better. And so I basically putting my idea of a citizen assembly out there when we come to a time when the kind of public interest and anger and so forth kind of builds that we want to do something. I wanted to have something that's worked out and thought through. And I think it could start on a state level if you had a reform governor, a state legislature, or the initiative system could get it going someplace. Now, let me just switch briefly to
I'm afraid,
the last caller.
Yeah, we've only got 30 seconds, so I'm going to have to cut you off here.
Let me just say one more thing on that.
I can't even let you do that, Kevin. I'm sorry.
All right.
Kevin O'Leary, thanks for joining us this morning, the author of Democracy in America. It's published by Stanford University Press, if you'd like to learn more about it. Carmen Jackson produced this hour, and we had on-air production from Cale Plowman as well. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.